The next discussion we're having is CITES and import and export rules and regulations and laws. And for that, I want to turn to someone, Craig Cooper, who is probably the biggest expert in the U.S. on that.
Physically, obviously. Can everyone hear me about this?
Yes.
So we're actually going to break this into three parts. I'm going to give sort of the 30,000-foot view of CITES, how CITES works, and how it's implemented in the U.S. And Merrick will talk a little bit about our permits program. And then Brad will talk a little bit about the import-export process. And so we'll give you about, 25 minutes or so. Not each. And then open up to questions and revisit some of those questions that came up earlier that perhaps we haven't answered yet. So, just the basics of CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, which we in shorthand call CITES. It's a terrible name because it has the phrase endangered species in it, and yet 95% of the species it covered are not endangered. There are now 176 member countries, thanks to Bahrain, who joined about 2 weeks ago. We refer to those countries as parties. CITES is always a party. So the goal of CITES is to ensure that international trade in wild animals and plants does not threaten their survival in the wild. That's the mission. It establishes an international legal framework with common procedures and mechanisms. It's not terribly prescriptive. It basically provides a framework, and then it's up to those 176 member countries to figure out how they're going to implement the treaty domestically. One of the best ways I find to talk about CITES is to talk about what it's not, because there are a lot of misconceptions out there about what CITES is, how it works, and what it represents. One is that CITES addresses all aspects of wildlife conservation. It does not. It is meant to deal only with international trade in species listed in its appendices. Another is that CITES bans trade in listed species. That also is not true. CITES has three appendices. We'll talk about each of those. One of them essentially bans commercial trade, and less than, 7% of all species in CITES appendices are listed in that appendix. The vast, vast majority of CITES is not about a trade ban. Another is that CITES regulates domestic trade. It does not. It's about the movement across international borders. That's where it operates. Another is that the CITES appendices are a listing of the world's endangered species. And we talked, there was a question earlier about ESA, the Endangered Species Act, and CITES, and why weren't they all lumped together. And one reason is that they're basically different lists of species. There is some overlap, but they're different lists with different criteria about how you get on them. The appendices list only those species that are or may be affected by international trade. Trade is not specifically an element in the ESA list. It doesn't have to be a species in trade. Okay, so the three appendices I talked about. Appendix 1, about 1,000 species. Species threatened with extinction. There's, for the most part, no commercial trade. There are always exceptions. Requires both an import permit from the importing country and an export permit from the exporting country. Appendix 2 covers over 30,000 species. There are roughly 35,000 species listed in the CITES appendices. Most of them are listed, almost all of them really are listed in CITES Appendix 2. There is one single group of taxa that make up almost 30,000 of the 35,000 species listed in the CITES appendices. Those are orchids. And if you take the rest of the 5,000, it's still mostly plants. All cacti, a number of other succulents that are listed, and the animal taxa that are listed in the appendices is a relatively small number. Appendix 3 is about 300 species. The purpose of Appendix 3... Oh, I'm sorry, let me back up to Appendix 2. These are species that are vulnerable to overexploitation, but not at risk of extinction. Commercial and non-commercial trade is allowed. Requires a permit or a certificate issued by the exporting or re-exporting country, not required by the importing country. Appendix 3, the purpose of Appendix 3 is to address legal origin, not sustainability. Appendix 1 and Appendix 2 are about both legality and sustainability. Appendix 3 is just about legal origin. These are species protected by at least one country that has requested assistance to help regulate trade, and these can be listed unilaterally. The United States can list something in Appendix 3 at any time. To list something in Appendix 1 or Appendix 2, you have to go to what's called a conference of the parties, which we'll talk about in a minute, and you have to get a two-thirds majority vote in order to get that listing to happen, or a down-listing or a delisting for Appendix 1 and Appendix 2. Appendix 3 is unilateral, doesn't require a vote. Okay, so CITES operates essentially on a three-year cycle. About every 3 years, all of these parties get together in a single place. The next meeting is in March of 2012 in Bangkok. And all of these countries get together in a room or two rooms, and they...
2013.
March 2013. Review how the treaty is working. They resolve policy issues, amend the list of protected species, Appendix 1 and Appendix 2, and work together to ensure that wildlife trade is carried out in accordance with the treaty. That happens about every 3 years. In between that time, there are a number of committees that get together to work on specific issues and to keep sort of the momentum going of those things that were decided at conferences of the parties. Every year, a body called the Standing Committee meets, and the Standing Committee provides general policy and operational direction to the CITES Secretariat, which is the sort of governing body of CITES, which is in Geneva, Switzerland. So that's what the Standing Committee does. They advise the other committees, the Animals Committee and the Plants Committee, as appropriate. The Animals and Plants Committees meet also once every year. They fill gaps in biological and other specialized knowledge, undertake periodic reviews of listed species to decide if they're listed appropriately, and they advise when trade in a particular species may be unsustainable. Just to give you a sense of how big these things are, the Conference of the Parties, I think, is probably around maybe 3,000 people, maybe more. The Standing Committee has become sort of a massive event as well, probably, I don't know, 1,000 people. Government entities, as well as non-government entities, there's a very big role for NGOs, for industry representatives at these meetings. They are allowed to speak, they're allowed to participate in working groups, NGOs and industries are allowed to do everything except for vote. And the parties do the voting, but other than that, it's a very collaborative process. Okay, CITES in the U.S. The Endangered Species Act is the implementing legislation for CITES. There's a section within the Endangered Species Act that specifically refers to CITES. The Secretary of Interior is designated to implement CITES, and it has delegated, the Secretary has delegated that authority down to the Fish and Wildlife Service to be both what's called the Management Authority and Scientific Authority. The Management Authority issues the permits and makes what's called a legal acquisition finding. The Scientific Authority makes a couple of other findings, most significantly what's called the non-detriment finding. Our regulations are based on the convention text and current resolutions adopted by the parties. They can be found primarily in 50 CFR Part 23, but there are some elements in some of the other sections as well. And these include definitions and U.S.-specific information. Okay. So just to sort of drill down a little more to the reason we're here, there are 76 reptile species and 17 amphibian species in CITES Appendix 1. This is a sampling of some of the species listed in Appendix 1. Appendix 2, again, 30,000 species listed in CITES Appendix 2, 582 reptile species, 113 amphibian species, and these are some of the taxa that you'll find in Appendix 2. And what you'll see here is a number of what we call higher taxonomic level listings, all crocodilians, all chameleons, all tortoises, all varanids. And there's a way to list things in the CITES appendices at a higher level, particularly if it will be difficult to implement a species-level listing because of identification. If it's difficult to identify one species from another, or to make it a little bit more complicated, a woman's shoe made out of snake skin, if it's difficult to identify one species of snake from another species of snake when it's in that kind of a form, you might be able to pursue what's called a higher taxonomic level listing in CITES Appendix 2. Okay, and then Appendix 3, again, these are the unilateral listings. 56 reptile species, 2 amphibian species, and again, there are some examples there. The United States, up until relatively recently, didn't have any Appendix 3 listings. Now we have all map turtles, alligator snapping turtles, and most recently the hellbender. And I think I'm going to hand it over to Amneris now.
Our office, which is the most loved office in the entire Caribbean Coast Plain. So I will try to not scare you guys, but permits are a conservation tool, and I will try to understand that they're not as bad as that.
So there's no like hermit Nazi up there who sees things.
Okay, our office will only deal with planning permits, as Greg said. Also, we deal with other domestic regulations as a part of our permit program, which includes the Endangered Species Act, the Golden Eagle Protection Act, Lacey Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and the Wildlife Conservation Act. So, just to give you a perspective, we issue a lot of permits. We have to take care of a lot of regulations. CITES is just, as Craig mentioned, an international treaty regulating the international trade. Besides that, we have to take care of all the other regulations, I mean, the national regulations that we have in place as well. Who we work with in the Fish and Wildlife. With law enforcement is a very important part of the work that we do, since we are in charge of issuing all these CITES documents, ESA permits. We work together with law enforcement for the implementation of CITES. With the Endangered Species Regional Offices, the Migratory Bird Regional Offices, the Wildlife Refuge, and also within international affairs. Why permits? Permits, believe it or not, enable legitimate activities that will otherwise be prohibited by law. Also ensure activities are carried out in a manner that safeguards wildlife. Consider risks and benefits of proposed activities and base permit decisions on best available science. Promote conservation by authorizing scientific research and monitoring activities consistent with species enhancement. Generate data and allow wildlife management and rehabilitation. Also help to conserve wildlife and their habitats, although most people are unaware of the role. Can tell us something useful about the resources they regulate. Allow us to monitor activities to determine how they affect protected wildlife populations and enable scientists to conduct research on protected species to develop information needed to assist with their conservation. So it's very important, and I always tell my permittees how important it is for us to be involved, because the information that we gather, not only from scientists but also from breeders, from commercial breeders and all that, to help us have a productive and permit program. You know, we are here because of you, basically. And that's why we need your input in order to make this permit program work. As Craig mentioned before, you know, DMA implements CITES and through the permit issue process. And last year, we issued approximately 25,000 permits. And documents under all the regulations, not only the international treaty that we have to comply with, but also with all the national regulations that we by mandate have to issue permits for those proposed activities. And most of the permits that we issue on our office are, you know, our studies, but as Craig said, most of the species that are listed under science and are plants. Lots of them. So. For the last 3 years, This is the data that we have. The permit, the CITES permit that we have issued for rental Palestinians in the last 2 years are 7,500, and until like 2 weeks ago, you know, for this year so far, 5,760 permits for rentals. Out of those, you know, if we say 7,000 out of that 26,000 permits that we issue per year, you see how the percentage belong to the rental and amphibians, right? And for amphibians, 68, 79, and 18, respectively. We issue CITES, but also some of the species are listed under the Endangered Species Act. Therefore, if they are protected under different regulations, another authorization will be required for the proposed activity. Some of that is very important for us to know specifically the scientific name of all the species, so we can do all our findings based on each of the regulations. Sometimes we have a species that is CITES, that is ESA, and we have to separately go through the entire reviewing process in order to meet the CITES criteria and the ESA criteria. So it's very important to be aware that on our website we have a lot of permit applications, and each of them for a particular activity. And you're more than welcome to browse our website. And I know that most of our permittees know our website better than we are. And the application forms are, the numbers are 3-200, and then the other numbers are related to the particular activity that you will be conducting. For instance, we have the 24, which is for the export of live captive birds. The 27, the export wildlife removed from the wild. The 73 for re-exports, and those that are familiar with our permits, some of them are done at our port for re-exports. And 42, the most loved injurious wildlife. Basically, once we have the application is on our website. You download the application, and the process is just to complete the application as fully as possible. The processing time is probably, considering the volume of applications that we receive, plus all the other stuff that we have to do, it takes up to 6 days. Why? Because we have, you know, we need to be sure that it meets under size the criteria of legal acquisition and a non-detriment finding that is done by the Division of Scientific Authority. Once, if the applicant meets the criteria under CITES for a permit, the permit will be valid for 6 months, which means that you will have 6 months to conduct, you know, to ship that, those animals, please don't wait a day before to do it, because we want to be sure that the foreign country will receive the shipment during that window. Once a shipment is taking place and is over there and is commercial, if the other country will not accept that, it's up to them to do whatever they have to do. We cannot do anything since commercial shipments, for that we do not issue retrospective permits. Of course, we have to comply with all the special conditions on the permit, and also you must comply with the foreign country regulation. And by that, I mean that Fred mentioned Appendix 1, 2, and 3. For Appendix 2, import, the United States does not require an import permit like the European Union requires. So you have to be very sure that you are in compliance with both countries. A couple of years ago, we came up with this idea of setting up master files. These are the new type of applications that we have. Most of them are our reptile breeders for certain native species on CITES, and also the establishment of master files for animal breeding activity. Those are the kind of applications that we have new available for the people that are interested on. And again, if Lucidia. Yeah. Basically, just complete the, you know, the application as soon as possible. We take every application on a case by case, and everybody has different documentation or different activities. And if you have any question, I mean, the key is to provide a complete application that allows us to meet the criteria so we can issue the permit so you can legally export your animals overseas. And that's basically how we manage our permit program in a nutshell. So, that's it.
My name is Brad Lance. I'm the supervisor of online inspector for the Port of Houston. I'll go ahead and pull up my presentation here real quick. I have four inspectors at Port of Houston for air, sea, and rail cargo. So just scroll through the volume of imports and exports we have, we're stretched pretty thin. In the United States, we only have about 120 wildlife inspectors for the United States. That includes one, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands. So we're busy. All the time busy, and we see lots of different interesting items. There is a general procedure for importing and exporting. I'm going to gloss over it. It's in theory, it's easy, but it's not exactly simple. Okay? Basically, you fill out your forms, you give us your permits, and you're good to go. Let's see, symposium and decoration right there. Okay, if you're a commercial importer and exporter of wildlife, in this case, let's say reptiles, we'll figure. First thing you need to do is obtain a fish and wildlife import and export license. That's the first thing you need to do. That allows you to commercially import and export wildlife into the United States. It does not mean you can import without declaration. It does not mean you don't need site use permits. It does not mean you don't need to pay fees. All that does is allow you to import and export commercially wildlife into and out of the United States. You still need to do all the other requirements, such as the declaration, get your site use permits, and anything else that's required. Next thing you need to do once you have your import-export license, call your local wildlife board. Call your wildlife inspector. Make an appointment, because they are there to help you get yourself in and out of the country legally. Some of you might not believe it, but we're here to facilitate trade. We're not just an enforcement agency. We want to make sure that the stuff that is able to go into and out of the U.S. does so legally and as quickly as possible. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be super fast, because like I said, there's only 120 of us in the entire United States. But we're not here to slow things down for no reason. Okay, once you've made your appointment by calling the appropriate inspection office and speaking to an inspector, you submit your Fish and Wildlife Declaration form. This is a form 3-177. Now, the best way to do this, and I mean the best way to do this, is electronically. We have an electronic declaration site. It's edex.fws.gov. Now, if you use that site, don't put www in front of it, you won't get there. It's just edex.fws.gov. You set up an account, it's free to use the system, you can save your information, and that way when you go and do another import or export, you don't have to keep putting your address and business name and all that stuff in there. Now, you can also do the next step online, and that's paying fees. Fees are required for commercial imports and exports. There are two different types of fees. There is what's called an inspection fee. That's a flat fee. Depends on what type of port you use, and I'll talk about different ports in a minute. But that's just a fee for the inspection. We also have what are called premium fees. Premium fees come into play when you have live animals and when you have protected animals. You need a permit for CITES or PSA. Now, you have your inspection fee for your commercial shipment. If you're shipping a CITES to animal, then you get the CITES premium fee. Now, that is per shipment. If you have five different animals or five different species that require a CITES permit, and it's in one shipment, it's one premium fee. It's not one fee per different species on the declaration, on the export. So you got that one premium fee for your CITES animals. Then you have the premium fee for your live animals. So you have the inspection fee, premium fee for live animals, premium fee for CITES. Then you go ahead and pay those. You can do that online through the EDAC system. They take credit cards, really easy, you don't have to worry about sending a check to official wildlife. You can also create what's called a corporate account. I think they bill monthly. Basically, you just set it up with the port you're at. And then once you're in the system as a corporate filer, you'll get a bill. You don't have to pay each and every single time. You just pay that monthly bill. Next, you provide your inspectors the supporting documentation for the shipment, permits, invoices, airway bills, anything else associated with the shipment as far as paperwork goes. Now, in the case of shipments that don't require special permits like CITES permits, you're shipping a non-CITES lab now, you can actually do this electronically. There's an e-scan system. It's not very important yet, but if you have non-protected animals that you want to ship out, you can submit your documents electronically. That way you don't have to physically hand them to an inspector prior to the shipment. Now, for CITES permits, or endangered species permits, we do still need the originals, so you can't just scan those and send them into us. Once you've gotten all the documentation, you set up your appointment, you pay your fees, you show up at the inspection. The inspector will inspect one of two ways. We either do a physical inspection, where they actually open up the shipment, verify everything is correct, and close it back up, you're good to go. Or they'll do what's called a paper inspection. Not necessarily on paper, but they're going to look at the documentation that you give and decide whether or not to physically inspect it. If they're satisfied with what you've got, they can go ahead and clear it without actually looking at your shipment. Then if everything's good to go, if it works correct, they'll stamp off any permits that you have and go ahead and give you your clearance. Now, if you're doing an EDEC, an electronic declaration, you'll get this clearance electronically. Some ports, such as Houston, will go ahead and stamp any paperwork that we have, so it goes up there's at least something physically stamped. Some ports just clear it through the EDEC system. You get an email saying it's cleared, you print it out, and you have a 3177, it's got a clear stamp at the bottom. There are three different types of ports. This is kind of confusing. They're what's called designated ports. These are the ports that are the biggest ports from the wildlife inspector there. These handle commercial shipments from all over the world. As you can see, I don't know if you can see very well, Boston, Los Angeles, Miami, Houston were designated ports. These ports are the cheapest ports to use. We have what's called border ports. As you can imagine, they're on the northern and southern borders. Now, if you have to have a permit, like a CITES permit, an endangered species permit, migratory bird permit, you can't use these ports without a special permit. You have to have a special dispensation to use these ports if you have a CITES permit or another type of permit. Okay, there are further restrictions. Northern border ports, that is the Canada-US border ports, may only import or export wildlife to U.S. or Canada country of origin. Southern border ports, as you may expect, you can only import or export items country of origin, Mexico or U.S. There are exceptions. You can get a designated port exception permit. This will allow you to import or export at one or more of these border ports. Unfortunately, these are higher than these ports. They're not as well staffed, so they're more expensive to use. Even more special are the special ports. Basically, these are U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, and specific Alaskan ports. You can only use these ports with a shipment that has a final destination of that territory or state. For instance, if you bring something into the Virgin Islands, that's where it ends up. It has to stay there to use these ports. Again, if you have to have a CITES permit, migratory bird treaty permit, endangered species permit, without that designated port exception permit, you can't use these ports. Again, the fees are higher. If I remember correctly, they're even higher than the non-designated ports. And that's the CFR reference if you're interested in finding out exactly what ports are imported over the islands. Just real quick on the CITES requirements. CITES 1, basically non-commercialization. You can't commercially trade any CITES 1 species. Okay. Like a statement, there may or may not be exceptions, but usually there are not. CITES 2, we require an export permit from the country of origin. Now, this export permit has to be validated on, usually on the bottom. What validation is, it's the export authority in that country, whether it's a wildlife inspector, a customs inspector, or their equivalent. They actually are supposed to review the CITES permit, stamp it off, make sure the quantities are correct, and then it's good to go. CITES permits without this validation are not considered a valid CITES permit. So if you're getting a shipment from a foreign supplier, you have to stress that it has to be done, it has to be validated, or some people say verified, but validated on export. Because when it gets to the U.S., if it's a commercial shipment, we don't have a lot of leeway. We're supposed to reject it. And that may result in your shipment going back to the country of origin. And we don't want that. We all want that. So if you're getting CITES species in, make sure they know to get that validated. That is what I really want you all to take home from this. We see a lot of that. That's not our biggest problem. Aside from you not learning things at all, people don't have a correctly validated CITES card. And that's the showstopper. CITES 3, these are listed by unilaterally, as you all said, by individual nations. So there's a little twist in a CITES 3 animal. If you're getting a CITES 3 animal from another country, you do require an export permit if it's from the country that listed the animal. If the animal is listed in Nicaragua, you have to have a CITES permit from Nicaragua. However, if you have an animal that's listed in Nicaragua, if you're getting it from Costa Rica, you need what's called a CITES certificate of origin. Generally, we don't see very many of those, but we do accept CITES permits for CITES certificate of origins. And that's perfectly fine. A lot of management authorities don't do a CITES certificate of origin because they just do the CITES permit. Yes, how do you know which country was there now? If I remember correctly, on the CITES website, you can go through the listing and it'll show you which country listed the CITES 3 animals. And that way you'll know exactly whether to do a CITES permit or CITES certificate of origin. Generally, it's easiest just to get a CITES permit. For instance, we see a lot of animals from Zimbabwe. They use a CITES permit for everything. CITES 1, 2, 3, they use a CITES permit for it. They use a CITES permit for their export permit for non-CITES animals. Some countries do this. And we accept that as an export permit. So if you have a CITES permit for a CITES 3 animal, that's perfectly fine. And all the regulations for CITES can be found in 50 CFR 23. It's long and can be kind of confusing, but if you have any questions, call your local wildlife inspector and they can help you out. We'd rather you actually have the information, they come to us and try to figure it out at that time when you're trying to ship something out and have 5, 10, 15 different things along with it. If you're really feeling kind of masochistic, you can look up the federal regulations on it at this website here. This is actually the best place to go, the federal regulations. It's continuously updated and it's broken down by which CFR it is. For instance, 50 CFR is Fish and Wildlife. You pull that up, you look up the various species, CITES, you name it, it's on there. And then if you're interested in the customs tariff regulations, you can use that site for customs as well. Now let's see. Additionally, important export information is online on the Fish and Wildlife website. If you go to the Fish and Wildlife main page at www.fws.gov, on the left there's a link called Imports and Exports. That'll take you to a page where you can download forms for the 3177. We do accept paper declarations, but please use the electronic system. It's easier for everybody. That way, if there's a problem, you just click a button, it comes up on an email, you have a problem, you fix it. And there's no paper back and forth, there's no way. Also, you can get forms for your import export license, numbers for your local wildlife office, and pretty much everything else you need to import and export. Thank you.
Are you talking about the validation at the bottom?
Exactly.
Unfortunately, no, because like us, we validate at the bottom of CITES permits as well. And as far as I know, there's no listing of inspectors that you can use to verify. If there's a problem with the CITES permit, we can always send it up and have it verified through the management authority. They'll contact the management authority of the other country and verify whether it's a valid permit or not.
So you can verify it before the shipment.
The validation is supposed to be done on export. So technically, you shouldn't be able to do that. Generally, if it's stamped and signed by the exporting official of that country in the validation block, we accept it. Unless it's a stamp we've never seen before, or it just looks like there might be something amiss with it, we'll send it up for verification.
Conditional release,
yeah, if we feel that's warranted, yeah.
Yeah, I think there are two different things there. One is there's the authority that signs across the stamp at the top, and that there is a sort of a log of who's able to do that, but it's present at the bottom, and then it's thousands and thousands and thousands of people who have the authority to do that in different countries. And so there's checking on, is this a valid CITES permit, versus checking on, is this a valid validation?
Right, yeah.
Years ago, I brought in a shipment from Honduras, and CITES was in Spanish, and they seized my shipment.
Well, the three languages that are recognized CITES languages are English, Spanish, and French.
Yes.
So, yeah, it would be valid.
Mark?
Of those numbers that Amneris showed, 7,000, 7,500, and 5,000 something this year, how many of those are master file, or is master file not actually included in that?
For those 7,000, I think they're mixed. They're mixed, the quantities. Because so far, since we start to implement these master files, we have probably 52 permittees using master files, and out of them, we are issuing single-use permits.
Right.
But I think it covers, it could be more, more permits.
So the numbers went up significantly when master file came into use?
Well, it could, we will talk about that. It could be more or it could be less, but it depends on, let me rephrase this. The master files allow for this to issue single-use permits, and those single-use permits could be more or less, depends on the season. Sometimes we have high season, low season, but I think it's more, over the years, seems to me that those are the numbers.
Just to clarify for people what this master file system is, it allows us, so you apply once,
yes,
and you have the authority then to get a number of partially completed permits. So you can get like a stack of partially completed permits, and you fill in the quantity and the recipient and that. So it's a way of going through the painful part with the initial process, but then being able to get a bunch of permits that you can use over a period of time. And it's, as Amnera said in her presentation, it's only for certain kinds of activities.
Yeah, for certain species and for certain activities, and we can issue permits out of that. That particular master file will be valid for 3 years. So we basically will be issuing all the single-use permits that you request to us. Of course, there is a condition on it that they have to report every time they request single-use permits, so we can monitor the proper use of the master file.
And the fees are much lower as well for the master file process.
When did you guys implement the master file program?
2008, 2009. Yeah. Yeah. We have that for other kind of permits like plants and Appendix 3 species, but with the reptiles, we started like 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah.
What are some of the more common problems that you guys see with CITES permits?
The common problems?
Yeah.
In terms of when they submit the application or the use or misuse of the permits?
Both.
Well, each application that we receive, we review it in a case by case, because some people have more knowledge of what they want to do. Some people sometimes they are new into all this, so basically problems that the information that they submitting show legal acquisition,
mm-hmm.
that the parental stock has been legally acquired.
Right.
That's not a problem. Usually they provide that information, but sometimes we have to go further,
mm-hmm.
since we don't have like an application that will cover every single information that we need,
sure.
for every applicant that application that we receive. And showing legal acquisition and meeting the import-export license that they have to have in order to do it commercially. Sometimes they require to go to a non-designated port, and they need to know that a non-designated port exception permit is required,
mm-hmm.
to export through that particular port.
Okay. Questions from the panel?
Yeah, I think that the thing that comes to industry mind is the whole issue of, is appendix 2 animal lay eggs, and those babies that hatch out, are they appendix 3? How's that whole thing working?
Okay. So there's no, yeah, the only change in appendix based on method of production has to do with appendix 1. So built into the treaty, in Article 7 of the treaty, there's an exception that basically says that appendix 1 species that are bred in captivity are treated as if they are in appendix 2. And that's the simplest way to say that. Now, the complicated way to say that is they're treated as if they're in appendix 2, but they have to meet the definition of bred in captivity under Resolution Conference 10.16, and you have to be a registered facility with the CITES Secretariat, and you have to go through that process of registration where other parties can object to that registration. So it's once you get to the point of being a registered facility, your specimens are treated as if they're in appendix 2 and you can trade in them commercially. When I said that there are some exceptions to commercial trade for appendix 1 species, that's the big one. The big one is if you're a registered captive breeder and the Secretary of the Registry, then you can trade in those specimens commercially. And the best examples, there are a huge number of Asian arowana breeders, fish farms in Asia. There are some, a couple of parrot registered facilities. There's a tortoise facility in Mauritius right now that is trying to become registered. And falconry, a lot of falcon breeders that are registered.
Crocodiles.
And crocodiles, yes, absolutely.
How do you apply for that?
You apply, if you're a U.S.-based captive breeder of an Appendix 1 species, you apply to us. We review the application to make sure it's complete. We forward it to the CITES Secretariat. They post it as a notification to the parties. The parties have a month or 2 months to raise any objection. If no objection is raised, you become a registered facility. If an objection is raised, then there's a process for sorting out that objection.
It has nothing to do with endangered species. Like if it's an endangered species, appendix 1, and you still can't ship it over state
lines. ESA is a whole different matter.
Yeah, yeah.
How many such applications have you all forwarded today?
So when we amended our CITES regulations for the first time in 30 years in 2008, we changed our regulations to reflect what the resolution requires for registered facilities. And as soon as we did that, as soon as we said you have to be a registered facility in order to export Appendix 1 species for commercial purposes, we got a lot of applications. And by a lot, I would say, I don't know, a dozen. And they were almost exclusively for raptor breeders. Maybe one or two for parrots, although I don't think we've registered any facilities. And I don't, I was about to say that none of our facilities have been opposed by any other party, but we were strenuously opposing the Philippines parrot breeding facility, and so then the Philippines started opposing all of our facilities, but I think we're past that now, I hope.
Is the application per species or per facility?
It's per species for the facility. So in other words, if you are a registered to breed a particular falcon species, a raptor species, and you want to do another one, you have to register. You have to re-register.
When do I get that application form? Can we get that online or?
Yeah, most of our application, all at our way, they're on our website.
What kind of turnaround time are you looking at in most cases if there's no issues?
For a permit?
Yeah.
For you mean for appendix 1 registration?
Both.
You do the first
one. Okay, I will do the easy one. For any kind of application, if it's a CITES application request, when we have all the information that we need in order to make the vote findings, it could take less than 45 days.
Okay.
Once it's an ESA related and it's in danger and we have to send it to another reviewing offices or we have to publish on the Federal Register for public comment review, that would be 90 days plus.
Okay.
For marine mammals that we also issue permits for, it could take more than that, a year.
Better leave the seals at home.
So depends on the type of activity, but most of the commercial stuff and the reptile business that I personally do, most of them, they're quite, very straightforward.
For appendix 1 registration, I'm ballparking, but I would say probably somewhere in the 3 to 6 months range. But once you're registered, you're registered.
What's the pushback on issuing appendix 3 permits for Carolina,
appendix 2.
Appendix 2.
So there's box turtles were listed in appendix 2, I don't know, a dozen years ago, something like that. CITES COP 10, I want to say. We were talking about this earlier. I think we have issued permits for box turtles, for captive produced box turtles. If we want to go back in time to when they were first listed, I think the pushback related to the fact that Louisiana was the only state with a lawful harvest from the wild, and we were not able to make a non-detriment finding for the regime, the management regime that they had in place. But that was a long time ago, and I don't know of any, I personally don't know of any applications for wild caught box turtles that we had to review. Yeah, captive.
Yeah. Again, probably we have been issued for zoological institutions or stuff like that, but for commercial, I don't recall.
You've been shipping south of the Redwood.
Timing?
There was for a year a shipment which CITES out of the U.S. to Walco.
But how many years ago?
The year after they gave it to CITES, I'm going to tell you. But it has happened on a small scale.
Yeah.
The bottom line is if we can make a legal acquisition finding and we can make a non-detriment finding, then we can issue a permit.
The problem is also states are closed. So if your founder colony is 10 years old, all I'm going to do is give you pictures of the founder colony, show you that we can produce them, show you the eggs, show you the babies are all the same size, the shells are perfect. That's all I can do. So it's up to you then to issue the permit. Because the state's closed.
Right.
5, 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Right.
All the states.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I had this discussion on the side, how can I show lawful acquisition? And there's just not one answer to that question because it depends on the species, it depends on the regime, in some cases, when we're doing Appendix 1 pre-convention guitars made out of Brazilian rosewood, it might be a sworn affidavit. There's just not a straight answer of, this is the prescription for how you show lawful acquisition, because it's just going to depend on the particular species and the legal regime.
Is there any rule about not exporting a locally captive bred appendix 2 species? Because in the ripple industry, we all know that you're not going to get export permit for wood turtles. Wood turtles are not exported out of the U.S. and they are bred by the thousands. But is that a rule or just a point of view from the U.S. fishing wildlife?
Blandings aren't even listed. I don't know. A Blandings export wouldn't come to us, but I believe a small number of Blandings turtles have been exported. And the issue, it again, goes back to what are the state regulations. If there's no state that is open to Blandings harvest, then that's going to limit the extent to which there will be Glanding's exports. Your question about wood turtles, it's going to depend on, again, whether we can make a legal acquisition and non-detriment trade. There's no blanket, we won't allow the export of wood turtles. It's more a matter of, can we make the finding given the regimes that are in place?
From what you're saying, the most, no matter how well you can document the founder stock, you're still going to have this no detriment thing that's going to be an end all, right? I mean,
no, I don't think so. I don't see why there would be sort of a blanket, we can't make a non-detriment finding for anything.
So, regardless of the situation of the animal in its range, if the adults are legally verified by you guys, they should be able to get a permit.
If we can make both findings.
Both findings.
And the non-detriment findings made by the scientific authority, we work for the management.
So what is factored into the non-detriment finding?
Is that particular activity a threat to the survival of the species in the wild?
So if somebody's breeding them out of the range, how would it be a threat?
That's a good question. We're sort of going down the rabbit hole a little bit. One might be if it is going to stimulate trade in a species that is specifically closed from trade, and they're trying to manage the species by not allowing trade. I mean, that's a factor. I'm not saying that's a blanket. We're not going to make a non-detriment finding in that situation, but that's the kind of thing that we would take into account.
You said you're not specifically closing that one to trade.
So let's go back to the Australia examples that we talked about repeatedly. One of the things that we would factor, I believe our scientific authority would factor into making a non-detriment finding is this trade going to in some way undermine the management regime that the Australians have put in place for their species? I'm just saying that's a factor. That's something that they would consider. I'm not saying that would result in a detriment finding or a non-detriment finding.
So when you say closing the trade, it's by you or by the state or by another government from another country or another part of the world. Like his example, the wood turtle.
Right. What I'm saying is we don't have a blanket. We're not going to issue permits for wood turtles. What I'm saying is we'd have to look at what state regime is in place. Are they protected throughout their range? Okay. Were they legally taken recently? Can you document that the founder stock was lawfully acquired? Can you document that they're so prolifically produced in captive breeding environments that trade's not going to be detrimental to the survival of that species in the wild? Those are the kinds of things that we look at.
And just because we make the legal acquisition finding, and you know, we could find the legal acquisition as a part of the criteria, but if scientific authority cannot make the finding, you will not get a permit because both of two criteria must be met in order for us to issue a permit.
But yeah, and just to be clear, because we seem to be talking about the things that aren't in trade, you know, we export huge numbers of map turtles, we export huge numbers of alligator snapping turtles, we export tens or hundreds of thousands of alligator skins, river otter furs, bobcat skins. I mean, there is a very large trade in a number of native CITES listed species. So I know we've sort of honed in on a couple where there perhaps haven't been well represented in trade, but there's not some attempt to not allow native CITES listed species out of the country.
One of the concerns that I heard about the Raftemis listing was that by listing that and protecting all map turtles and being able to monitor it and all those good things that you did it for, what you also did was you took everybody out of it who didn't produce them themselves. In other words, the people in Louisiana and other states who produce large quantities of Raftemis, all the map turtles that can go out into the free. If a guy in Miami who doesn't have anything to do with it, but he wants to ship 500 to Karim in France, and now Kareem's going to see the paperwork, he's going to see where that map turtle came from, he's going to bypass the guy in Miami, which is almost exactly the case. I don't know if the Kareem gets
how would he see where they came from?
I don't know, I'm asking.
He wouldn't.
Yeah, he wouldn't know.
No,
because I know that nobody else
is
exporting
them from.
So that permit comes in France or wherever, Appendix 3 with an origin, with a producer on it, it's not going to be seen by just
doesn't have that. No, it'll only have the exporter.
if they are concerned about if that person in the other country will be able to know the origin,
right.
No, because all that information is protected under the Privacy Act.
Okay.
The permit only will have the name and the address of the permittee for the exporter and the importer, but not where the animals came.
When an animal is listed on the New York City stack, does it automatically go to the heading one of CITES?
No. When CITES was first agreed to in Washington in 1973, and then when the appendices were created after that, CITES went into effect in 1975, a lot of the ESA-listed species automatically got sort of dumped onto the CITES appendices. But the criteria are totally different. There's no interconnection. There's no if it goes on CITES, it gets into the ESA list or vice versa. They're separate processes with separate criteria.
So there are ESA animals that are not CITES?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Not CITES listed at all.
At all.
And there are CITES species that are obviously not ESA listed.
Craig, can you explain a little bit about the meeting of the parties itself? There's 35,000. Does that mean there was 35,000 votes since CITES came into being?
Or no. So the conference of the parties?
Yeah.
You mean 35,000 species?
Well, right. So
for example, when orchids were listed, they were listed probably under one or a couple of proposals.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those higher taxonomic level listings where you were able to show essentially these orchids need to be listed. And all these other orchids, when they're not in bloom, look exactly like all of these other orchids. So we need to list all of them, at least in CITES Appendix 2. So they went in as all one proposal.
So if you go to the next meeting and you decide that you, like you have a, right now you have a, what's it called, the proposal?
Federal Register notice about what we're thinking right. about taking.
Well, no, yeah. I think the Center for Biodiversity is pushing you to list bunch of species, right?
ESA listing. That's an ESA petition.
That's
has nothing to do with what we take to a CITES.
So say you go to CITES and you want to list the landings for like this.
Yeah.
What happens at that point? You want to go there with a briefcase full of stuff? You're gonna get your 5 minutes on the soapbox, or how does it work exactly?
Great question. So the process is all listing proposals have to be submitted to the CITES Secretariat 150 days in advance of the meeting. That just happens to be next Thursday. So anything that we're going to submit for the Conference of the Parties in March of next year has to be submitted by next Thursday. That's true for us. That's true for Zambia's elephant down listing proposal. That's true for the UK's shark listing that they're pursuing. All of those things have to be in by October 4th. If they're in on October 5th, they will not be considered.
And if you submit that now, you don't have to ask for it there, but you can if you don't do it now.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the door is closed to us. We can withdraw it at any time. Let me sort of back up further. Our process, is a very public, very open process. The first thing we do after a CITES conference is we put out a Federal Register notice saying, what do you, the American public, think we should take to the next CITES meeting? You provide your comments. You say, you know, this box sort of really needs to be in Appendix 1. I know that's what you said. And so we take all that information in, and then we publish another notice saying, okay, this is what you American public said we should take. We are likely to take these, we're unlikely to take these, and we're undecided to take on taking these. And then we go through a process of evaluating each of these suggestions, and we decide what we're going to take to the conference of the parties. And then we announce what we're taking and what everyone else is taking. We'll do that in December. And we will say, okay, American public, what position do you think we should take on all of these proposals? Do you think we should vote for it, vote against it? And then we receive that information and we develop negotiating positions that we publish again in the Federal Register saying, these are our tentative negotiating positions going into that. So we submit a proposal on October 4th. We go there in March of next year. We are allowed to it's our proposal, so we're going to propose Blanding's turtle for CITES Appendix 2, theoretically. So we go there and we say, okay, we'd like to propose the Blanding's turtle for CITES Appendix 2. We're in front of 175 other countries. We think it meets the listing criteria because there are this many in trade and because this is the biological status and because they're protected by these states, and we lay out our case in, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And then other parties and non-governmental organizations and PJAC and everyone else is allowed to stand up and say what they think about our proposal. And then after all of that, if we decide that we still want to go forward, it's put to a vote. And 175, 176 countries get the opportunity to say yes, no, or abstain. And two-thirds of the voting countries have to support that proposal for it to get listed. And that's what happened for everything that we have that's listed in Appendix 1 or Appendix 2. Appendix 3, as we described, is unilateral because it's us trying to protect our own population of species. So when we listed map turtles or alligator snapping turtles, we just let the Study Secretariat know, we want to list these species, they're protected, you know, in these states in the United States, and we're calling on the rest of the world to assist us in ensuring that that international trade is legal. And that's done unilaterally, they notify all the other parties, and it's a done deal.
So is there a lot of discussion, did a bunch of parties come up, or everything's still closed?
Well, so if we took a Blanding's turtle proposal and Zambia takes an elephant down listing proposal, which one do you think is going to get more interesting? We spent a lot of time talking about elephants. We spent a lot of time talking about sharks. We spent a lot of time at the last conference talking about bluefin tuna. We spent a lot of time talking about whales, Japan puts forward a whale down listing proposal. We spent a lot less time talking about spiders and turtles and other things. But that doesn't mean that countries don't do their due diligence and come in with a position. Not all of them. Equatorial Guinea probably does a little bit less than we do in developing negotiating positions. But there may be 50 listing proposals and 75 technical implementation issues on the table at that meeting. And we have a 3 to 6 page negotiating position on every single one of them.
How often do animals get downlisted?
We intend to take a couple downlisting proposals to this next meeting, I think. We're hoping.
Any reptiles or amphibians?
No.
Is there any reptiles or amphibians going to be proposed?
We don't, believe it or not. Welcome to the election season. We as of today, don't know what we're taking to the COP. We would like to know, but we don't know.
But why is it that CITES has a vehicle in place to register a farm for Asian arowanas, endangered species, and they fall under Appendix 2 and you get commercial trade? Endangered species doesn't have that. You can only sell within the state. It restricts trade for people that have to breed legally obtained boundary.
Right, and I'll, a couple of things. One is that's not entirely true because there's the Captive Bred Wildlife Registration System under the Endangered Species Act, and there are CBW registrants around the country. It exists, even for reptiles. So it's very limited, and we had a conversation during the break about that. It's limited. Both the breeder and the recipient have to be CBW permit holders, but so there's a mechanism there. The other thing is I would say is, you know, we're implementing the legislation that Congress gave us. And that's true of the Lacey Act, and that's true of the Endangered Species Act, and that's true of the treaty to some extent because we signed on to this treaty as it's written. It hasn't been amended in a couple of decades. So, you know, those are sidebars that are given to us. There's some flexibility in some cases. We, like I said, we have the CBW registration system. It's cumbersome, but it's because that's the way the statute gave it to us.
What year was the CITES conference in Fort Lauderdale?
It was COP9, and it was 1994, I think. Unless it was the one before that, so maybe 91.
Well, I attended.
I think 94
was there.
94.
I was there also, and the impression I got, strictly as a, you know, an NGO just outside looking in, that the United States and Switzerland nominated a lot of animals, and many of them were opposed by the range states where the animals occurred, and many of them didn't make it.
Yeah.
Now, is that a pretty common thing, that we would propose an animal for protection in the country where the animal comes from, or oppose it?
Are we still being filmed? I would say it's more I would say it's more common if you're in the United States than if you are Madagascar. You're right, I think we took a lot of proposals to COP9 in Fort Lauderdale. One of the reasons I think is because we were the host country. I think the host country often takes a lot more than they normally would. But no question that the United States takes more listing proposals and more other documents to meetings than most other countries. We took a lot to COP10 in Zimbabwe. I was there as an NGO for that, and a number of them were for native species, and almost all of them were rejected. And there are various reasons for that, and we could go into that, but it's sort of a long discussion. I think we have taken fewer proposals since then. I think the number's been going down. I think the number will be relatively low this time as well. So, yeah, the answer to your question is it depends. But yes.
Well, I've read somewhere where the United States Forum recommends in Bangkok that core Trifasciata be moved to Appendix 1. Is that straight skinning, or is that still on the table, or what?
So
I'm a breeder of that animal. That's why
I can tell you what we said in our last Federal Register notice, and that was that we were undecided on a large number of listings. And there were a lot of Asian turtle species that were where we were undecided, and it remains to be seen what we will take forward.
Okay. Well, a prayer, if you're a Christian or whatever, a little prayer come into this, or?
You can try.
Okay. Anything worth the
trouble. So, I don't know how to say this off the record, but it sounds like international politics and how happy other countries are with us in other areas has something to do with this, and that's just the way the world works.
Yeah, I would say that what happens at a CITES meeting is no doubt an intersect between biology and law and politics and international relations. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we have tried to do and been very successful in doing over the last couple of conferences of the parties is having co-sponsors that joined us. And in fact, speaking of Asian turtles, we have worked very closely with the Chinese on that issue. Not necessarily on these listing proposals that may or may not be coming, but on the process of looking at the Asian turtle trade and taking steps to improve how CITES is being implemented, particularly in Asia. At the last conference of the parties, building on that experience, we co-sponsored a document with the Chinese focused solely on the Asian snake trade. And it is inconceivable to me to this day that the Chinese were willing to co-sponsor a document with us which basically pointed the finger right at them. But they did. And we had a workshop in China focused on that issue. We've done IUCN red list assessments based on that. We are likely to get some species listings coming out of that process. But, you know, it helps to be, you know, to go in holding hands on something like that, particularly when otherwise it might be seen like the United States, you know, pointing their finger at someone and saying, fix your own problems, and maybe not looking at, you know, how we're doing things here.
So you have 6 days to decide what you're going to bring there. Who makes those decisions?
Well, we know what we want to bring there. Mm-hmm. We have 6 days for other people to decide whether we are, will or not. And so it depends. I'm going to go completely theoretical here. Mm-hmm. And say if we were taking a map turtle Appendix 2 proposal, it probably wouldn't go farther than the Director of the Fish and Wildlife Service or the Secretary of Interior. If we were taking an elephant uplisting to Appendix 1 proposal, it would probably go to the White House. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on the amount of attention it's likely to get. You know, the thing that's been in the news a lot relates to the polar bear and whether we will or won't take an Appendix 1 listing proposal to the next conference of the parties. Obviously, that's of interest not only to the Fish and Wildlife Service, but to the State Department and to the White House and a lot of other countries.
So if it's the least known, least exciting salamander, who signs off on that one?
It'll still go up through the Fish and Wildlife Service to the Department. The CITES delegation is generally headed. It's interesting. CITES is one of the few treaties where the State Department is not the lead. They don't like that. But that's the reality. So the head of the U.S. delegation is usually someone in the Department of Interior, usually an assistant secretary or a deputy assistant secretary, or the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service. But there will be members of all those other agencies who are interested on the delegation. State Department will be there, U.S. Trade Representative, U.S. Department of Agriculture, within the Fish and Wildlife Service, Management Authority, Scientific Authority, Law Enforcement, all of these agencies play some role, and so they all participate in the delegation, but it's headed by either the department or the Fish and Wildlife Service.
So they all get a free trip to Bangkok.
Well, if you consider sitting in a conference room about 10 times larger than this for 2 solid weeks, about 12 hours a day, a free trip, then yes.
We get Saturday and Sunday off.
Well, except that one of those days is usually a working day.
Pat phones up too.
Bangkok.
I'll experience Bangkok when I walk from the venue to my hotel and back.
I was going
to
say, does the Hilton bar look any different in Bangkok than it does in Houston?
Yeah.
It's actually a very tedious
process. What, obviously there are governmental organizations involved in the science programs. But you use the acronym NGO, which is non-governmental organizations. What are some of the non-governmental organizations that are involved in CITES?
For those of you who have been to a conference of the parties, correct me if I'm wrong, I would say that the participants are probably 60% government and 40% non-government. And so on the non-government side, you have a number of the groups that we've talked about today. Defenders of Wildlife, IFAW, International Fund for Animal Welfare, Humane Society of the United States, Humane Society of International, World Wildlife Fund, Traffic, other groups, PJAC, it depends on the proposals. You'll have maybe whaling industry people there or fur industry people there. The U.S. state agencies go as NGOs. They go as the regional associations of fish and wildlife agencies, so they're well represented. We also take a state agency person on our delegation to make sure state interests are being represented. I don't know, Mike, who else? In the NGO world, it's certainly more conservation and environmental groups than industry, but there's a balance there. The cosmetic industry was there at the last conference of the parties. The Marine Mammal Parks and Aquariums Alliance, so whatever that group is called, is there. American Zoo Aquarium Association is there. Anyone have a permitting question?
That's how I felt earlier.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking like on the ant show in Germany. If I go over there and say I buy some animals, and is it up to me to prove that they were captive bred, or is it up to the person that exported them to prove that they're captive bred if the legal ones to be here?
Are you talking about CITES animals?
Yeah,
or? Generally, when we receive a validated, correctly filled out CITES permit from the country of export, we accept that CITES permit. So if it says captive bred and it's a validated at the bottom CITES permit and everything else is correct, then you would go ahead and accept that.
Yeah, and so if you were bringing them back with you, though, you are the exporter, so it would be up to you to get that documentation, right?
You'd have to have the permit prior to leaving. You'd have to get the permit from the country of origin and bring it back with the animals.
And regardless if the species is listed or not under CITES, any wildlife must be inspected and declared at the time of importation with these guys.
Right.
About what is the percentage of animals that you're trying to tell other countries what to do with their animals compared to what we're putting up to defend our own stuff?
You mean in terms of things that we're taking forward to a meeting?
Like Asian turtles, you know, we're telling them.
Yeah.
Trade side,
yeah. Well, you know, and certainly with some of those trades, it's not necessarily a U.S., there's not necessarily a U.S. role, but and we are probably the world's second largest consumer of wildlife. So we're playing a role for a lot of the proposals we're putting forward, even if we're not the range stake for those proposals. That's a tough one. I'd have to go sort of meeting by meeting. And, you know, we probably took, I don't know, 5 proposals to the last conference of the parties. It wasn't like a huge number. And it's usually a mix, maybe a couple of native species and a couple of non-native species.
Yeah,
and, you know,
we're defending one of those wildlife and one defending another. Just sort of where we sit on compared to other ones.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure the state agencies would necessarily say that we're defending our own when we take a native species proposal, because they maybe more often than not would rather we not do that. But not always, and we work, again, very closely with them and try to be on the same page with what we're submitting as well.
Well, kind of a general question. Our industry, reptile industry, is made up a lot of importers and breeders and distributors and retailers. Even of all the importers involved, I used to be one. It's a strong feeling of the industry, really, that captive breeding is the answer to assurance colonies, pressure off wild animals, public knowledge, information, basically for the best of the interest of the species themselves, and I think that's why you guys are in existence too. Do you guys share that feeling?
That there's a role for captive breeding and conservation? Absolutely.
Do you think that there's a role for commercial captive breeding?
Do I personally? Well, I don't know if anyone else wants to jump in here, but no. Yeah, I mean, going back to what CITES is about ensuring that wildlife trade is conducted legally and sustainably. Whether that's wild-caught animals or captive-produced animals, that's the goal. And that's the goal that my office means to achieve, ensuring that wildlife trade is conducted legally and sustainably. And one of the things, Mark, that may get to that issue is the perception and perhaps the reality that it's a lot easier to get a permit for wild-caught animals, to export wild-caught animals, than captive bred, or to re-export wild-caught animals than captive bred. And that's true to some extent because the findings are different. For example, and I don't know if we talked about this, but our Office of Law Enforcement actually issues a lot of our re-export certificates. And the only thing you have to demonstrate in order to get a re-export certificate is that you filled out the application, that you paid the fee, and that you provided proof that the animals were lawfully imported into the United States. So if you have a canceled CITES permit and an application, you're good to go. If you're trying to export something bred here in the United States, we have to make that extra finding, that non-detriment finding. So it takes more time. And maybe that sends a mixed message, but that's not the intent. It's just the reality of processing those different applications.
And the non-detriment findings are already being done for you, essentially.
Right, that's basically what we're saying is, okay, country X already made a non-detriment finding. It was lawfully imported into the United States. Here's your permit. Here's your certificate.
Do you think that in the future we might think about a different way of treating captive bred species? Because if we have a look at the figures, actually, most of the reptiles, in fact, it's iguanas, but most of the reptiles are captive bred on the trade of the CITES reports. And the fact that we have to go through all the paperwork for captive bred animals, which doesn't cause any problems, we don't have any problems with breeding ones, actually. Do you think that we might think about a different way to treat that problem?
I think the master file is a good sign.
Yeah, but master file is in the U.S. only.
Yeah.
It's not something we use.
Yeah, okay. So this has been so nice. And now we're going to get into a little bit more challenging area. In our view, one of the biggest challenges with regard to CITES implementation around the world is what I would call a significant trade in animals that were wild caught that are traded as F1, captive bred, or ranched. I think it's a system that has been abused in a lot of places for a lot of different reasons. And when we went to the last conference of the parties, we co-sponsored an EU document asking to look into this area specifically, to look into how CITES is being implemented for captive bred and ranch specimens. And I actually chaired that working group. and we put forward a whole suite of recommendations to this next conference of the parties coming up in March to look at how we can strengthen CITES implementation for captive breeding facilities, how those facilities should be inspected, how we can verify the accuracy of the claims that they're being bred in captivity, that they're meeting the definition of captive bred in 1016, and how we can provide capacity to those countries where these captive breeding activities are going on. And this is, I mean, I think a lot of people in the room probably know a lot of the examples out there, but in fact, we put forward a whole bunch of specific examples. These species in these countries, reptiles coming out of Indonesia, you know, certain tortoises coming out of Eastern Europe. We, at our own risk, you know, sort of pointed the finger at about 25 different specific examples, and we said, we need some case studies. We need some people, some experts to go to these places and to verify whether this stuff's going on or whether animals are just coming out of Madagascar, going through some third country, and getting a permit that says C, when in fact they're not. So I agree that there should be some leniency when it comes to green iguanas, and when it comes to Appendix 1 species that are clearly being bred in captivity, and there are things built into the system and built into the treaty to do that, but there are a lot of problems in that area too.
And you take that stance, and that could weaken your position as a vote on the next meeting of the parties.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the recommendations we put forward, well, they're not U.S. recommendations. I mean, I chaired the working group, but I had membership from, I don't know, 30 countries. So there was a lot of involvement, and they actually go forward as recommendations of the standing committee because we did the work under the standing committee. We went to the standing committee and said, these are our recommendations, and they said, yep, and put them forward.
Craig didn't want to go back to Jakarta anyway. Yeah.
So if you recommend listing for CITES, who recommends listing for the endangered species?
I think that's the next panel.
That is the next panel.
Perfect segue.
We've got about 10 more minutes. So if anybody's got any more questions on Lacey Acted CITES.
I just looked at the last 10 years of import export data for California. I'm working with California Humane. And it seems like for certain genuses, there's a lot of imports coming in where it's not down to species. And it's just genus, so that's got to mean, how do you know what's coming in when you're letting it in? You know what I mean? You don't know what
right.
species it is.
In Houston, we require the genus and species. There are some animals that are Fish and Wildlife says you can declare as a genus. Coral, for instance, certain coral genera are allowed to be brought in under the name, the generic name. Without looking at exactly what animals.
That's amphibian.
Yeah. Let me walk that on the screen a little bit. So, I mean, what Brad's getting at is at the point of import, everything has to be declared, essentially, everything has to be declared to the species level. It has to be on the declaration, or the declaration has to refer to the invoice, and the invoice has to have that information. That's true for CITES species and non-CITES species. He mentioned one example of where it can be recorded at the higher taxonomic level
right.
for certain corals that can't be identified down to the species level. What you're talking about is basically what happens when the data off the paperwork gets put into the system. Into Linus.
Okay.
So a lot of that gets lumped.
Yeah.
So if you have 20 different non-CITES reptile species, we might, because of convenience, enter it into the system as a single line of 512 non-CITES reptiles. There was a paper written a couple of years ago about invasives that basically said, oh my God, we don't know anything about anything that's coming into the country because the Linus data just recorded tropical fish as freshwater or marine. Well, it's not true because that's what goes in the Linus. But if you go back to the hard copy paperwork, it's all there. Every species is on that invoice with the quantities involved. So it's about data interpretation.
Right.
It's not about how we're collecting the information at the port.
And that information is not, I mean, it's public, but it's on a hard copy. You've got to actually go through the records and find.
That's right.
Do you perceive them improving the quality of the data in the Linus system?
It improves over time. One of the things we found that if people are bringing in species that are not coded in Linus, we use a general code. Like, for instance, every week we get butterfly pupae coming in from Central and South America. A lot of those insects don't have species codes in Linus. So they're put under a generic non-CITES butterfly code. As time goes on, and we see these species more and more often, they'll get their own individual code, which improves the quality of the data. So it's one of those things where there are so many species out there, and new species are being brought in every day, pretty much, that we just don't have the codes in the system to identify it. And then as those species pop up more and more often, they'll get their own code and show up as species B in our data system.
What happens to a CITES species if the species is split?
You mean if the taxonomy gets split?
Exactly.
It's okay. So there are a couple of different scenarios, and we can go down the road here. So let's say you have a Varanus species that's listed at the... It's a terrible example because it's already listed at the genus, but let's go with it anyway. So if it's listed as a species at the species level, and then it gets split, but it's a recognition that what we're doing is splitting the species, then both are still covered by that original listing, and actually we continue to use that original taxonomy until we adopt new taxonomy. So part of there's another committee called the Nomenclature Committee, which decides what taxonomy we use.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. So let's say you have a listing, a genus level listing, but a new species is discovered.
Okay. As opposed to discovered in a lab by splitting an existing species.
Right. Yeah, so it was unknown to science.
Right. Okay.
Then I believe the answer, of course I give an example, then I don't know the answer. I believe the answer is it's not covered.
Okay.
Let's say you have something that's covered that is moved into a genus that's a higher level listing. I believe that's also not covered. So it depends on how the taxonomy changes and why the taxonomy changes. But if the original intent was to cover it, then it remains covered even if it gets split off taxonomy.
So if I discover Yetis, it's not covered by CITES yet, so I can...
Sell them quick.
Technically, the mammal reference that we use considers us to be in the order primates, and the order primates is listed in Appendix 2. So it's a good thing you have to cross an international border to get there. Otherwise, I'd be looking for your CITES.
Well, I think that pretty much... Well, we've got 5 more minutes to go. We can either take one more question, or we can take a break now. Anybody have a question?
I just want to commend the Florida Fish and Wildlife people for how well... I really think they've done a great job managing their wildlife. I really do. And I've been to shows all over this country, and I don't see tables at every show for the wildlife people, but I do in Florida. You know, and my hat's off to them. They've done a great job.
All right, let's take a break, and we'll meet back here at 3 o'clock and talk about the dangers.